Good evening and welcome to our Zoom event. I'm Richard Benson, a member of the board of the Chicago Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society. And on behalf of the board and our president, John Adams, I would like to welcome you. And thank you for choosing to spend time tonight talking about tax. This is the Chicago Chapter's final plan event of the year, and we're excited about both the relevancy of the discussion topic tonight and also turnout from across the country. Thanks again for making time for this. Tonight's discussion is called Making Sense of Significant Potential Tax Reforms. It is a substantially broad title because this is a substantially broad and rapidly changing subject. A sharply divided Congress is rapidly proposing back and forth significant changes to the American corporate and individual taxation systems, as well as the functioning of the Internal Revenue Service in order to pay for substantial spending for both physical infrastructure and social programs, often called human infrastructure. Since we originally wrote the advertising copy for this panel, almost all of the proposed changes to the tax code have shifted in one form or another. Major proposals can be announced and squashed in news alerts within hours of each other. We had a major framework announcement last week, and even some changes in the House announced this morning. So what's a practitioner to make of this situation? Tonight, the Chicago Lawyers Chapter has invited three brilliant tax policy experts to discuss items of the proposed reforms that are significant to them. Naturally, we cannot cover every item of multiple thousands of pages of rapidly changing legislation, but nonetheless, we should hopefully be able to elucidate some major potential changes. As for the agenda for tonight, we will briefly discuss the current legislative state of play based on the experiences of some of our panelists who have experience in Washington. We'll discuss some of the major corporate and international tax reforms and some of the proposed individual tax reforms currently in the Build Back Better framework or budget reconciliation package. And finally, we'll just go into items of interest that our panelists want to discuss based on either past proposals or potential proposals here in within potential tax framework. So throughout tonight, please feel free to ask questions using the Q&A feature of your Zoom there in the bottom center of your screen, and that will help us to clarify topics as we discuss them, especially since the subject matter is a little bit freewheeling based on all the news and changes. It's very good if you need to ask a question, feel free to do so during our discussion, and our panelists will try to clarify things as we go. We'll also reserve some time at the end for more focused audience questions. And one last administrative point before I introduce our panelists. All three of our panelists here are appearing tonight under their own names and reputations. This event is being recorded, but please know that anything discussed here is merely the opinion of the speakers. It does not represent any position taken by or an endorsement by a firm, university, or the Federalist Society itself. All right, now I have the joy of introducing our brilliant panelists. First, our moderator, Richard Kaplan. Professor Kaplan is the Guy Raymond Jones Chair in Law at the University of Illinois School of Law. He graduated from Indiana University with highest honors and earned his law degree from Mayo University. He practiced law in Houston with Baker Botts, specializing in U.S. tax consequences of international transactions before joining the faculty in 1979. He's an internationally recognized expert on U.S. taxation and tax policy and has lectured in these areas on three continents. He's testified before Congress on several occasions and written innovative course books on income taxation and international taxation. Welcome, Professor Kaplan. Second, I'd like to introduce Professor David Gamage of Indiana University School of Law. He is a scholar of tax law and health law and policy. He has written extensively on tax and budget policy at both the U.S. state and federal levels, as well as on tax theory, fiscal federalism, and the intersections between taxation and healthcare. Professor Gamage consistently ranks in the top five of the SSRN tax professor rankings. From 2010 to 2012, David Gamage served as special counsel to the U.S. Department of Treasury, Office of Tax Policy. In that position, he administered the individual income tax portfolio of the Treasury Tax Legislative Council and oversaw all the drafting of individual income tax regulations, especially those relating to the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Please welcome Professor Gamage. And last, but certainly not least, please allow me to welcome Chip Harder. Mr. Harder is a senior policy advisor to PricewaterhouseCoopers, or PwC. He served as Department of the Treasury as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Tax Policy for International Tax Affairs from September 2017 through November 2020. As Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Tax Affairs, Mr. Harder was responsible for all international tax matters at Treasury. He played a central role in representing Treasury in the legislative process for the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the last major tax reform, which was signed into law in December 2017. Mr. Harder then led the development and issuance of an integrated set of regulations to implement the new international provisions of the TCJA, including the Global Intangible Low Tax Income Regime, known as GILTI, the Base Erosion and Anti-Avoidance Tax, known as BEAT, and the Foreign Derived Intangible Income Regime, known as FDII. Mr. Harder also represented the United States in tax negotiations at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. At the OECD, he led the efforts to revise longstanding international tax rules that provide for the allocation of taxing rights over multinational businesses, representing the U.S. on negotiations of both Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 proposals. In recognition of these services, Mr. Harder was awarded the Treasury Medal. Prior to joining PwC, Mr. Harder practiced in Baker & McKenzie. He's a member of the District of Columbia Bar. Once again, thank you so much for joining tonight, and I hope you enjoy making sense of significant potential tax reforms. I'll turn the panel over to Professor Kaplan.
Thank you very much, Mr. Benson, and I welcome all the attendees. This is a very unusual time to be talking about this because the subject matter is literally changing as we speak. Just to take one area that is particularly of interest to me because I have a focus on elder law as well as tax, namely the taxation of retirement plans and individual retirement accounts. There have been major changes proposed that were actually taken out of the bill on Monday and were added back about an hour and a half ago. These are primarily affect the mega IRAs. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about it later. But one of the things that's been most interesting about the development of this tax act is not only is it an attempt to raise revenue to fund the Build Back Better bill. Raising revenue to finance government spending is not all that unusual. But simultaneously, there's a parallel track that can best be described as the ProPublica reports that came out over the summer, one of which mentioned that Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Warren Buffett, and some other wealthy people had paid virtually no tax as a percentage of their net worth. And the concern was, how can this be sustained? Or more specifically, what can be done to the tax law to enable people who have incredible wealth but have chosen not to realize any sales nevertheless make some contribution to the federal fisc? That so-called billionaire's wealth tax had a long run, but seems to have disappeared. But the point is that has been a major motivator. ProPublica also issued another report in June, this one about Peter Thiel's mega billion-dollar Roth IRA. And that's been the genesis of a number of provisions affecting retirement plans. The point is that there are a whole lot of factors that have motivated the creation of this bill, which for those who are really into the details, you can Google Committee Print 11718. So that's Committee Print 117-18. I should warn you, however, that it runs 2,135 pages and does not contain a table of contents. So you may want to be circumspect as to both your printing of it and how much you scan it. I think that probably should get us going, and I'm going to turn it over, I believe, to Mr. Carter, who's going to describe a little bit about the process, because this is a different legislative process than has been the case in the past, and there's no doubt that it's taken on a special oddity in light of yesterday's elections.
Thank you, Richard. Yeah, the key political context here is that the Democrats need to pass this legislation with only Democratic votes. And with an evenly divided Senate, they can't lose any votes in the Senate, and they can only lose 3 votes in the House. So there has to be a compromise reached between the different wings of the Democratic Party and essentially achieve close to unanimity here. And this process on reaching a compromise that basically all the Democrats on the Hill can sign on to has been an epic tale so far, and it keeps having more twists and turns. In terms of where we are, I think we're tantalizingly close, and we have been for a few days, there has been hope that there will be a vote on the bipartisan infrastructure bill any day now. But to get the progressive support for that vote. They have been working on trying to define a framework or the statutory text around the larger reconciliation bill, which includes the various, you know, social policy and climate initiatives in it, and which is the bill that, you know, most of these tax changes are attached to. So, you know, it looks like they've, you know, reached compromises more or less on the size of the spending package. It looks like they're landing on having no increase in the headline tax rates for corporations or individuals, subject to lots of indirect increases for both. It does look like international tax reform will be part of the package. Late entry in the race, or one that was actually proposed all the way back in the Biden campaigns, but didn't look like it was going to be included, but suddenly has made it in at the last moment, is a 15% alternative minimum corporate tax on financial statement income, which we can get into in a little bit more. And yeah, also back in the running is a 1% excise tax in effect on corporations doing stock buybacks, basically a tax on 1% of the value of stock being brought back. Those seem to be the where things are looking to gel in the corporate area.
Great.
Okay, David, do you want to pick up from there and give us a very brief overview of some of the things you've been following?
Yeah, I'll just add a few comments to these excellent summaries of a chaotic unfolding situation. Why is it a chaotic unfolding situation? I think it's important to understand a few things as background. One, as a situation as of a few weeks ago, maybe let's say a month ago, general agreement, maybe approaching consensus that the Democrats were going to undo portions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which was passed by Republicans on a party line vote. And this is part of the motivation for major tax reforms to be passed now by Democrats on a party line vote, of course, with the hope of getting some Republicans to go along, but not much of a hope. Along with that, lots of understanding. Professor Kaplan points out the ProPublica reports have brought extra attention to the well-known among tax experts fact that most billionaires and ultra-wealthy individuals in general largely escape tax, most tax on most of their true income or true accumulations for wealth. My sense of the literature, the actual numbers are quite nebulous because it's hard to estimate what isn't reported and isn't known. But I think the best sense of the literature is that well over 3/4 of the true income of ultra wealthy Americans is never reported for income tax purposes and never taxed. And one might quibble on the exact number there, but that's generally understood to be the state of play. Nevertheless, that wasn't well understood among the halls of Congress outside of a few members who were especially care about such things until recently. Senator Wyden is an exception to that, and he and his team have been working on mark-to-market reforms for 2 years running now, mark-to-market reforms that evolved into the billionaires' income tax reform, which I will say more about in a bit. Let's rewind a bit. About a month ago, then, general consensus that Democrats were going to keep portions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, but unwind other portions, along with adding some number of anti-abuse rules and closing down of loopholes that allow aggressive tax avoidance, especially by the ultra-wealthy. Although with uncertainty as to the exact size of what was going to be in the bill and the exact number in which loopholes were going to be closed. My sense of the state of play is that most of the key players thought they were aiming on the high side and it was going to be watered down by Senator Manchin and other moderates as they approached the finish line. couple weeks ago, Senator Sinema threw a wrench in all of this. As far as I know, with no prior announcement or warning, ruling out the small, at that time, individual income tax rate hikes that were being proposed, unwinding the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and more importantly, ruling out the corporate income tax statutory rate hikes, partially unwinding the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. The state of play before Senator Sinema's wrench was whether the corporate income tax rate should be raised up to 28% or 25% or something in that range. No serious thought that it was going to go all the way back up to 35% where it was before the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, but also no serious thought that it wasn't going to be raised at least somewhat above where it was left for the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. After Senator Sinema's announcement, fair amount of chaos. Thus enters the billionaires' income tax reform, which is a revised version of the mark-to-market reforms that Senator Wyden and his team have been working on for 2 years. The argument being this is a way to raise substantial revenue without raising the statutory rates. And for a while, it seemed like both Senator Sinema and Senator Manchin and other key players were at least tentatively on board. I worked very heavily on this reform, especially last week, and I'm quite attached to it. And you'll see some bitterness from me eke out as to the current state where it's probably not going to be in the final reform, although there's some uncertainty about that. Senator Wyden is still pushing for it. There are other outside groups are still pushing for it or for some revised, possibly watered down version of it. Things are evolving. I believe that an op-ed co-authored by me and two other tax professors will be out tomorrow arguing in favor of this version of the reform. Nevertheless, as of very late last Wednesday night, a press conference was being planned for last Thursday in defense of this reform, and I got a call saying, we don't need you anymore tomorrow. We have an agreement, a framework that no longer has it. In place of the billionaires' income tax reform, as we'll discuss more later, is a new surtax on millionaires' income, which is effectively a very large tax hike starting at the 10 million and then 25 million level, but not a statutory tax rate hike to the actual rates, sort of a roundabout tax hike that has some advantages and some disadvantages by comparison. As of this afternoon, so we now have a Senate framework as of last week, along with other attempts at creating other packages in the Senate, including by Senator Wyden, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. So a tentative framework, but also other proposals being floated, and then it moves to the House. This afternoon, we have a House bill. It's not the final word even from the House, because there's other proposals being floated around in the House side that are various members are trying to add or make revisions in various ways, but it shows more or less where the House is. It's quite long, as noted. It came out while I was teaching. I have not fully reviewed it. I've seen portions of it. My understanding is some of the biggest changes is a large addition of a partial but large undoing of the SALT cap, the cap on the deduction for state and local taxes that was added by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. This is likely to be especially controversial. Senator Sanders has already come out against it. And I suspect the version in the House package will not pass, although some compromise may well. And then other details we can discuss as we go.
Thank you, David. The next item is to talk about corporate tax. But before we do that, I wanted to pick up on Professor Gamage's introduction of the SALT provision, because this may seem not as significant as it really is. The Tax Cut and Jobs Act, which was the big tax legislation during the Trump administration, had, as Professor Gamage indicated, a major corporate tax cut. That was financed by a variety of changes, and actually the most significant revenue raiser in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act was the limitation of SALT, the state and local tax deduction, to $10,000. So this is a huge item on a macro level, even though for particular taxpayers, it may not be as significant as it might seem. The latest version, as Professor Gamage indicated, raises it from $10,000 an annual cap to $72,500. which is a very curious number. And it would go in effect this year, actually, for calendar year 2021, and would last through 2031. So part of the idea is this would be giving up some revenue, and but for the 10-year window. And perhaps that is part of the reason they brought back some of those retirement account reforms. But the point is that the SALT cap is very, very important to a number of Democrats, particularly on the coasts. And they felt that they needed to have some gesture, whether this is going to be sufficient because it's not permanent, and whether it's going to be adequate because it's still a cap that is much more substantial than the current 10,000, but a cap nonetheless. This really takes care of most of the people that were affected by this. That is, the criticism of the SALT cap repeal was that it was going to be a windfall to the very wealthy, which seemed to be incongruous to what the Democratic Party was trying to propound. And by making a cap of 72,500, that will take care of some of that criticism. We could go on, but that's really the state of play for the SALT deduction. So at this point, why don't we transition back to Mr. Gerharder and talk about the corporate provisions and international to the extent you care to.
Thank you. There has been a certain gelling around the direction of the corporate and international provisions, as I alluded to earlier. Probably that the most important development is that, as noted, we do not look like we're going to have an increase in the corporate income tax rate, much to everyone's surprise. And so they have been scrambling to find replacement revenues for that, both in the corporate provisions and international provisions and elsewhere. Probably a central piece of the corporate reform package will be the reform of our existing so-called GILTI regime to have it converge more closely with what's being negotiated at the OECD, the so-called Pillar 1 or Pillar 2 global minimum tax. Now, for those who aren't intimately familiar with it, our GILTI, Global Intangible Low-Taxed Income regime, was enacted in the TCJA, 4 years ago. And as sort of a quasi minimum tax on the foreign earnings of US-based multinationals, in that it essentially looks at the global average foreign tax rate on the income of subsidiaries of US multinationals. And to the extent that average rate isn't at least 13 1/8%, there is a additional tax imposed at the US parent level to effectively bring it up to at least 13 1/8%. And this did not completely stop, the benefit of operating in tax havens below a 13 1/8% rate because of this averaging mechanism, that one could still, let's say, earn income in the Cayman Islands that's taxed at a 0% rate, let's say, and essentially cover the GILTI minimum tax liability on that income by cross-crediting higher rate credits in places like France, where the rate was 25% or so. So what it did achieve was that it put a floor on, a limit on the amount of tax planning US multinationals could do, and it limited the degree to which they could lower their overall effective tax rates on their income of their foreign subsidiaries. But it did not essentially take away entirely the benefit of operating in low tax jurisdictions with rates below 13 1/8%. In the course of OECD negotiations, starting about 3 years ago, some of our counterparties decided they liked the concept of a minimum tax, like the GILTI, and proposed folding a global minimum tax into the new international standards being negotiated at the OECD. And this is now referred to as Pillar Two. And they have a more ambitious agenda. They have all along been designing this to apply on a per country basis. So you look to each and every country in which a multinational does business, and to the extent it is not paying at least a minimum rate in that country, an additional tax will be imposed at the parent. And so, you know, if you're doing business in the Cayman Islands and paying a 0% rate, there would be a top-up tax equal to the difference between zero and whatever the agreed minimum tax rate is. And the prior administration was quite supportive of the rest of the world adopting a minimum tax rate to level the playing field for US-based multinationals, as long as our current GILTI regime was effectively grandfathered into the system. And so the US multinationals could simply live with the current grandfather GILTI regime. When the Biden administration came in, they wanted to double down on the Pillar Two negotiations and bring them to a successful close and raise the rate to 15% global minimum rate, so that to the extent you were operating in any country through a subsidiary and paying less than a 15% rate, there would be this top-up tax for the difference. And one key difference from applying it on a per-country basis is it creates a fairly powerful incentive on each and every low-tax country to raise its rates to the minimum rate, so it gets to impose the tax rather than have, you know, the parent jurisdictions and multinationals collect all the revenue. So there is a powerful agenda here to actually change the world through the Pillar Two mechanism, and by giving countries around the world incentives to raise their tax rates to the minimum rate. And the Biden administration has pushed hard to have that minimum rate be at least 15%. They apparently have gotten agreement that it will be a 15% rate. And the Biden administration has been fully supportive of applying this on a per country basis. And they have promised that the US will do likewise. So part of the Biden tax proposals has always been to reform the GILTI, to put it on a per country basis. In the Green Book, they were proposing to essentially make the GILTI top up rate like 26.4%, so that a US multinational doing business in any country at a rate of less than 24% would actually suffer a top up tax in the United States, which was a pretty breathtaking outcome, given that, you know, that is, you know, basically right in the middle of the tax rates of developed countries, and calling those, you know, low tax jurisdictions would be quite a change. Now, in the political process, and having to compromise with moderates, this has been pushed back on considerably. Yes, we'll have country by country, and it will probably be a top-up rate of only 15.8%, which is very close to the OECD Pillar Two agreement. And they're also proposing to do things like eliminate the allocation of domestic expenses to the GILTI basket for, you know, aficionados know that would eliminate the cost of lost domestic deductions arising in the foreign tax credit mechanism. But big picture, the administration proposed making the GILTI a far tighter regime than it is today, and even very tighter than the regime they had just negotiated at the OECD. And in the political give and take, this has been pushed back to essentially changing the GILTI to something that looks very much like the OECD agreement, you know, a 15.8% rate rather than 15%. It is per country, and actually probably deferring the start date for these GILTI reforms for at least a year to essentially give the rest of the world a chance to implement the more robust minimum regime before it's imposed on US taxpayers. In addition to the GILTI reforms, the other big items, one coming in at the last minute in response to Senator Sinema's refusing to raise corporate rates, is to impose an alternative minimum tax on book income, not on taxable income. So the political genesis of this has been that, you know, it has been observed that many large corporations in a given year may report financial statement income that is, you know, positive and large, but not have taxable income, given book tax differences. And this has been hard to explain politically, even though those differences are, for the most part, the result of tax benefits consciously given by Congress, such as accelerated depreciation or immediate expensing of intangible investments or R&D investments, all tax incentives that were meant to encourage certain behaviors and investments, or the result of net operating loss carryforwards that exist for tax purposes but not for financial purposes. So this will be quite an adventure. You know, this has been thrown together very quickly. It's being applied on an international basis to not only pick up book tax differences of the domestic operations, but also of the foreign operations of U.S. multinationals. And they've gone to some effort to prevent this new alt-min tax from negating the benefit of specific general business credits. But you know, it does seem to be like it would operate to take away the benefit of, you know, specific timing differences like accelerated depreciation. So it will take a while for people to digest all of the implications of this, and you know, it will be an adventure. The next and third major newcomer is this 1% excise tax on the value of stock redemptions made by publicly traded companies. And 1% is an interesting number. It looks designed to raise revenue, but not be so big to actually discourage stock redemptions by publicly traded companies, and perhaps not fully neutralize the benefit of redeeming stock rather than paying dividends. So, you know, we could spend a tremendous amount of time on any one of these topics, but let me yield the floor and we can go on to other topics that people want to focus on.
Thank you, Chip. Just before we do that, however, why don't you explain a little bit more about the global minimum tax in the sense that the OECD is a very large organization, but not all countries of the world belong to it. And this is a phenomenon that we'd seen over decades in international tax, that if there is one country, call it Cayman Islands, Netherlands Antilles, whatever, that wants to become the tax haven of the world, then it is difficult to get agreement. You might want to just perhaps explain a little bit about how the new proposal is going to arrest that phenomenon with the countries that have not chosen to be part of the OECD or this 130 plus country concordant.
Yeah, it's quite a negotiation. And yeah, I represented the US in those negotiations for about 3 years. And it's actually fairly cleverly designed in that if a critical mass of the larger holding company jurisdictions, the parent company jurisdictions, all agree to impose this top-up tax on with respect to revenues of subsidiaries of their multinationals that are operating in low tax jurisdictions. First, that creates a powerful incentive on those low tax jurisdictions to raise their tax rate. And then there's a backup regime called the under-tax payment rule regime, which basically applies to, let's say, payments by a US subsidiary of a foreign multinational that in a country that has not signed up for the minimum regime. So basically, let's say that there's Cayman Island based multinational that has a subsidiary in the United States and a subsidiary in some other country. If the US subsidiary makes a deductible payment to its affiliate in another country, the United States, under this under-tax payment rule, effectively gets to deny a deduction for the payment. And this, in the OECD context, is referred to as the under-tax payment rule. And it provides an incentive to jurisdictions that have multinationals headquartered there to adopt Pillar 2 and themselves apply this minimum tax at the parent level to avoid, ceding taxing jurisdiction to everyone else in the world. So it's a fairly clever set of incentives to both incentivize countries to sign up for Pillar 2 and adopt these minimum tax regimes, and for lower tax countries to raise their rate so they get to impose the tax at the minimum rate as opposed to letting someone else do it. And it would, if successful, basically reduce the differentials between interest rates in various jurisdictions. Instead of the difference between a 35% rate in the US and a 0% rate in various tax havens, maybe we're down to the difference between a 21% rate and a 15% rate. And those narrower differentials take the juice out of much international tax planning. There's just less benefit from aggressive transfer pricing or transferring valuable intangibles to low tax jurisdictions. It won't be the end of international tax planning, but to the extent the differences in tax rates between countries is narrowed, it could be beneficial to the overall system.
Yeah, I agree that it will certainly be disruptive of a century-old regime. Before I turn back to David, I may want to take a question that's come in from the audience, and It's addressed to exactly what you're talking about, Chip. The question is, will any quote unquote global minimum tax agreement have to be approved by the US Senate as a treaty, and then a treaty with the world at large, or a country by country treaty process?
Well, this minimum tax regime doesn't actually need, you know, each country to sign up for a treaty. I mean, the United States already has, you know, its prototype, the GILTI, that got implemented through domestic legislation, and other countries could do likewise. Now, it would be desirable if we could all sign on to a treaty or to coordinate these to try to make sure these regimes are consistent with each other to avoid, you know, risks of double taxation and the like. But this probably can and will take place regardless of whether there's a coordinating treaty, and though there are risks of going forward without coordination. Contrast this to the other part of the OECD agenda, which is, yes, referred to as Pillar One, which is a more fundamental reallocation of taxing jurisdiction with respect to cross-border sales. And that, you know, would be much more difficult to implement without a multilateral international agreement. Now, there is some debate going on, you know, as we speak, whether, you know, the United States would actually have to do it in the form of a treaty requiring, you know, 66 votes in the Senate, as opposed to domestic legislation that, you know, overrides inconsistent parts of existing treaties and authorizes the Treasury to go out and enter into basically intergovernmental agreements, one or more intergovernmental agreements that, you know, might not rise to the level of the treaty. But that this is a very fraught issue, both politically and constitutionally. So we'll, you know, stay tuned.
Thank you very much. I want to turn to David with some red meat, specifically the millionaire surtax, which he had mentioned in his introduction. And it is not really a new concept. And I'm not going to ask him to become the modern version of a criminologist of trying to dope out what the Soviet Union is trying to do in the context of Senator Sinema as to whether she would regard this or whether Senator Manchin would regard this as an increase in rates. But it does seem to be more of a traditional sort of tax concept than the mark-to-market or the wealth tax that was created, or at least would respond to the ProPublica article. Or to make it more direct, that is, if the millionaire surtax were to be enacted, I'm not sure it would really placate the people who were upset by the ProPublica article, because it's still going to focus on realized income and people who have enormous stock appreciation but have chosen not to sell it and have chosen to fund their lifestyle just by borrowings would still not seem to be subject to the millionaire surtax. But I want to turn it to David to explain a little bit about the millionaire surtax and what is motivating it and how it fits into the current animus to make wealthier people pay more.
Thank you. My understanding is, per the framework reached last week, that Senators Sinema and Manchin are on board. Now, why it is certainly true that this is more like a traditional tax rate hike than a loophole closer or a reform that would be aimed at getting at income that is not currently reached by the income tax or that it currently escapes the income tax, like a mark-to-market reform as Senator Wyden was proposing. But it is different from a statutory rate hike in some notable ways also. As to your bottom line question, I will say that it does not placate me, but and I'll build back up to that. So I'll say I saw proposed legislative language last week and also some proposed language earlier this week. I have not yet had the time to actually see the language that came through the House today. So I'm going to gloss over some details that may or may not reflect what's in the House and give you my general understanding of what's being proposed. My general understanding then is that this would be based on AGI, adjusted gross income. In other words, it would apply both to ordinary income and to capital gains. This is very important. And with respect to ordinary income, AGI is a broader measure of ordinary income than taxable income, because from adjusted gross income, various deductions are subtracted before you get to taxable income. These are ways in which this is not just a statutory tax hike, it's on a somewhat broader base. But the difference between AGI and taxable income is relatively minor compared to the difference, especially when we're talking about those with, you know, 50 million, 100 million, or a billion of income or wealth above, than comparing what we might call economic income, which would include unrealized gains. Unrealized gains are not part of this space. Also, the surtax, the first level of the surtax, kicks in above 10 million of AGI, and then another 3%, so a total of 8%, the extra 3% kicks in above 25 million. At least that's my understanding from prior versions of legislation, which I believe is still the case. Along with that, there's some anti-abuse rules designed to target the common tax planning transaction involving, or sets of transactions involving, the use of entities to circumvent the Medicare tax, which notably have been engaged in by many famous politicians, allegedly including President Biden, but previously presidential candidate Romney, many, many others. For a while, it was called the Gingrich tax, the John Edwards tax, just noting all the various famous personalities who engaged in this, you know, legally done right, arguably borderline if done too aggressively. But if these proposed reforms go through, my understanding is anti-abuse rules to shut this down. Along with that, there's a large number of anti-abuse rules that have been in different versions of this framework or proposed legislation. I'm not sure at the moment what's in the House bill today, but whatever that is, that those may or may not make it to the final legislation, and others that aren't currently in the House bill today may. Those include, I understand, in the House bill today, some rules targeting mega IRAs, as Professor Kaplan noted. There were quite substantive and elaborate anti-abuse rules targeting many tax planning games for escaping the estate tax via trusts that I believe mostly are not in the current House bill, although I'm not 100% certain of that, but still are floating around and may be introduced. I would in some ways consider the stock buyback tax that Chip talked about as one of these sets of anti-abuse rules, to the extent that you think one reason why stock buybacks have become so common as a way of circumventing the taxes on dividends, and in light of the fact that before the 1980s, stock buybacks weren't allowed for this, among other reasons. So there's an argument that the excise tax is meant to be a loophole closer for escaping tax on dividends. A number of other anti-abuse rules that are floating around, although, and some may be in this bill, some not. Back to the surtax, which is the big individual personal tax side revenue raiser at this point. I believe the estimates I've seen raise several hundred billion, so a quite substantial revenue raiser in the framework of this overall package. Note, because the surtax would apply both to capital gains and ordinary income, this to some extent would alleviate some of the planning games involving converting ordinary income to capital gains, including famously carried interest, but many other variations of such, although not eliminate. There would still be quite a gap between the top combined ordinary income plus surtax rate and the combined capital gains rate. This would bring us back to a world where the corporate tax rate is quite a bit lower for those in the applicable income range than the top partnership income, you know, personal income through partnership plus surtax rate. It potentially thus could bring us back to a world where the corporate form was used quite a lot for tax planning purposes, where earning income through a corporate form, even if you fully paid the corporate tax rate, although these tax planning techniques usually involve then trying not to fully pay the corporate tax rate through various means, but even if it was fully paid, could give a substantial tax cut so long as the income is kept in the corporate form long enough, and thus using the corporate form for deferral. And if you need cash out of the corporate form, the standard plan is to borrow against the appreciated assets in the corporate form. The larger or more aggressive or, you know, more infamous version of this game is sometimes known as buy, borrow, die. The idea is if you can earn your income in a manner where that income comes in the form of appreciated assets, rather than something that is taxed currently either as ordinary income or capital gains rates, if you can have increases in wealth, this is quite easy to do if you're, say, a real estate developer, and more or less easy or hard depending on how you earn your income, but quite common for many different forms of very wealthy Americans. The planning game then is don't recognize any of your income, economic income earned through appreciation of assets. In other words, don't sell or engage in other realization event transactions. To the extent you need money, borrow against those appreciated assets, which is a tax-free event. And if you're Larry Ellison, say, you can buy Hawaiian Islands and mega yachts and whatever else you like, but you can also use it to invest in new financial assets or effectively use the borrowed money any way you would use normal money. And at the end of your life, theoretically, the stepped-up basis rules mean that the economic income that was never subject to tax will now never be subject to tax, and your estate can pay off the debt. More advanced version of this often use trusts, and so stepped-up basis on death is only a portion of the component about how things are bailed out at the end. There's many more complicated variations of the strategy. The underlying point, though, is that the surtax wouldn't get at this at all. And so the surtax would raise quite substantial revenues, so it is scored, from what you might call the working rich, or those who have 10 million plus of AGI from wages and salaries, or from other forms of business activities where realization and recognition is not easily avoidable, such as many, including very wealthy hedge fund managers, for whom realization is unavoidable. But for those very wealthy, the majority of the 100 millionaire and billionaire class who primarily can earn their income in forms that circumvent needing to have realization and recognition event, the surtax rules would not raise revenue from them. For that, you need something like Senator Wyden's proposed billionaire income tax mark-to-market rules, which would have combined a mark-to-market regime for publicly traded assets, meaning for stocks, bonds, and the like, there would be deemed realization. You'd be treated as though you had sold your assets at the end of the year for applicable billionaire taxpayers based on the market trading price. And for other illiquid assets and non-publicly traded assets, there was a deferral charge based on eventual realization event, plus a large number of anti-abuse rules designed to shut down the common strategies today whereby very wealthy taxpayers are able to defer gain and then get access to those gains without triggering realization events. So there's much more that could be said about that for and against or alternatives, but something like that is needed in order to get at the reasons why ultra-wealthy taxpayers currently escape tax on the majority, probably over 3/4 of their economic income. The surtax would collect revenues from, again, what we might call the working rich, are those who are already paying significant, substantial amounts of tax, and would raise the effective tax rates on those Americans to quite high levels by recent history or by comparison to other nations, but would do nothing about the underlying gaps in the tax system that the ProPublica reporting and the like has popularized.
Thank you, Professor Gamage. Actually, I wanted to pick up on a point you made, and that is that this deferral works in some ways because of the unlimited step up in basis at death. And as I think probably everyone on this call realized, that was one of President Biden's proposals. He talked about that on the campaign trail. So unlike a lot of the other provisions that we've talked about today, that was one that he sort of test drove during the campaign. It is not a new issue. It was attacked, at least rhetorically, by President Obama. And actually, President Clinton tried to take a swing at that as well. But actually, President Biden had come up with a more lucid rationale, or at least a more compelling one, namely that he said he wanted to raise the tax rate on capital gains. But as he pointed out, that was going to be ineffective if people had the ability to simply hold the asset until the rigor mortis sets in, at which point the entire gain would be forgiven through the step up in basis rule. So the premise was, if you want to raise tax rates on capital gains, in order to do that effectively, you must end the step up in basis rule. Now, before Senator Sinema took the whole idea of raising tax rates on virtually anything off the table, that seemed to have a compelling rationale. At this point, do you hear much about it? It's not in the current bill. Is that because of still the fallout of Senator Sinema, or is there more to it than that? Because there was already going to be a big exemption for farms, which has a political saliency.
The tax experts, left, center, and even most of the right, generally all agree that the stepped-up basis loophole is bad policy and should be removed or replaced with something or limited quite substantially. This is about as much. Few items can generate as much consensus in tax policy circles. Conversely, all the polling finds that to the extent the public understands it, they don't like it. What does this mean? It's largely a framing issue. There's a saying in politics generally, which I think especially applies in tax politics, when you're explaining, you're losing. In order to get to the point of explaining why tax experts almost universally favor ending the stepped-up basis loophole, you have to explain how deferral works, what capital gains are, what realization is, or at least some subset of these things. That's hard. It doesn't sell well. On the other side are slogans about family farms, about it not being real money, about paper money, about weird stories that are almost certainly fabricated, but have lots of money behind them and powerful interest groups. And we've attempted to end the stepped-up basis loophole a number of times over the years, and it's successfully been gotten rid of twice, both times repealed retroactively or put back in place retroactively. My view is that it's hard, based on the political communication challenges. Ending stepped up basis directly is a very hard hurdle to overcome. So the billionaire income tax proposal of Senator Wyden's, by the way, they might not like me saying this directly, but had anti-abuse rules that for billionaires effectively got rid of the stepped-up basis rule, although not quite so directly, but also got rid of a whole bunch of other related loopholes that President Biden wasn't necessarily planning on targeting directly. A number of tax experts have said, how can you think you can do a billionaire's income tax mark-to-market reform if you can't even get rid of stepped-up basis? But that's in the context of thinking about tax experts' discussions. If you look at polling or communications with anyone who isn't a tax expert, billionaires' income tax or anything of that sort polls extremely well. If the argument is we should make it so billionaires can't easily escape the income tax, that polls even better. And if we then are talking about an anti-abuse loophole closer that's a component of such an overall package, that is easier in my view to understand and communicate, still subject to attacks from the other, you know, on all the same dimensions. But all of a sudden it's the other side that has to explain, do the explaining of why those tax make sense, rather than starting out with the heavy lift of explaining what realization and death and stepped up basis and all these things are. this is not the standard view in tax policy circles that I'm giving you. This is the view articulated by myself and a co-author in a recent article forthcoming in North Carolina Law Review, among other places. But this is my view on the likelihood of success. My sense is, even if the stepped-up basis repeal had made it into the legislation, as it had in the past, there's every likelihood of thinking it would have been repealed over the next coming years, and quite possibly retroactively, as has been the historical experience, where if we can get a more comprehensive reform that can be meaningfully and truthfully communicated as something like a billionaire income tax reform, or a let's fix the income tax for the very wealthy reform, whatever you want to call it, that's more, although it might have more opposition in terms of getting initially enacted, it's more likely to be sustainable because the purpose of what is going on can be communicated to voters, and not just voters, but the ordinary congressperson for whom all of these discussions are otherwise quite arcane. More could be said in all of that, but that's my shortish answer to your question.
Thank you, David, very much. Actually, I wanted to pick up on your point about the consensus among tax professionals in favor of repealing the step-up and basis rule. There is one other major provision that in this bill that there is a large and broad consensus, and that is that there should be a beefed-up enforcement of the existing tax law. That is, the idea is before you start raising rates, whether on corporations, on individuals, on capital gains, it would be better to make sure that you're collecting all the tax that's due from the current law. This is a motion or a kind of thesis that wins a lot of support across the political spectrum, including from Republicans, many of whom see it as an alternative to raising rates, which they have a pathological aversion to. And so it's better from their perspective to go ahead and collect the taxes that are already legislated. If we can kind of channel George Herbert Walker Bush, this would not be a new tax. You're just collecting existing taxes. And it's pretty hard to argue against not enforcing existing taxes. This is sometimes described as trying to fill the tax gap. And the current legislation, the current bill, doesn't talk about how they would do it. It merely talks about here is some additional funding, somewhere is up around $80 billion or so over 10 years or substantial amounts of that towards boosting enforcement of the IRS. There's pretty wide agreement among tax policy people and people who just follow the administration of the tax law that the IRS is underfunded and outgunned. Some of this is deliberate from people who were opposed to some of the apparent ideological enforcement on the charitable organization side. Some it's been more a matter of a kind of inflation erode the capacity of the Internal Revenue Service. But a recent study showed that about the top 1% of taxpayers actually underpay their taxes by about $160 billion a year. That's just the top 1%. And so the response was, imperative is to provide the IRS more resources to collect the taxes due. Some of this is directed towards updating their technology. Now, this is a reference that many people will not get, but actually the IRS computers still run on a computing language known as COBOL, that's COBOL. And so many people will say, what was that? And that's kind of the point. The best estimate is there's about a $7 trillion tax gap. And then, which is another way of expressing, is about 15% of all total taxes. Now, the question of how that will be done, rather than just writing a blank check to the IRS, that there is more in the weeds, and actually the new legislation doesn't go into that. There was a widely panned and discussed proposal to provide reports directly from banks to the IRS if total receipts exceeded a certain amount. And so one threshold was going to be $600, which kind of ties into the 1099 filing threshold that was pretty quickly raised to $10,000, which is the threshold for where banks have to report individual transactions already. But the idea was to have some kind of automated process by which banks provided information to the IRS. This, of course, would be largely information overload unless they got updated enforcement mechanisms and rewrote these literally half a century old code. But the focus was not so much, to use Professor Gamage's phrase, about the working rich, the high income people, but rather people who had, in the technical phrase, opaque income streams. That is, income where there is no third party reporting. It's been known for literally decades that even very high salaried CEOs report virtually all of their income, that the income from wages is reporting is almost 99% of what it should be. No big mystery there. All payors of salaries reported, and they even withhold the taxes. And there's pretty high, though not as high, reporting from interest and dividends, where there are the ubiquitous 1099s and other kinds of third-party reporting. But when you're talking about pass-through entities, partnerships, particularly so-called cash businesses, it's not quite the case. Some of the premise was that there's also been a lot of retirements within the IRS. This is not a quick fix, that the audits of the top 1% have actually declined to the point that there are more audits of earned income tax credit claimants because so many auditors of the top tier taxpayers have left the IRS and not been replaced, to say nothing about newer challenges, cryptocurrency, offshore accounts, the underground economy. A lot of this is extremely hard to quantify, and it's the idea is that this can't be ignored, particularly at a time when the IRS not only is understaffed on the audit function, but also just the front-facing consumer service. So how much of the tax gap is due to people really wanting to find out the true answer, getting themselves in the queue, but then finding that they can't get an answer even after waiting an hour or longer? The most recent tally shows that the IRS answers less than 30% of all questions from the public. The revenue shortage from this is incalculable, but it certainly has to be among the lowest hanging fruit. And so the notion is that there should be a major push towards tax enforcement. This is not really, as I say, a democratic idea. This is one as about as bipartisan as it's going to get, but it does poll well at one level until you get into some of the details. And it's very easy to demagogue about the IRS is going to hire an army of auditors and that sort of thing. If it's a matter of, well, we're going to translate their computer code into something that is spoken by living beings, then it's not quite as unusual. But the point is the prospect is to have about $7 to $12 trillion collected over 10 years, and that this would go a long way of to making the tax code both more fair and also bringing in more revenue without necessarily needing to change rates and irritate Senator Sinema. In the remaining time, I did want to just bring up a little bit about these retirement accounts. There is some amazing stuff going down that is very much geared to the Peter Thiel approach of the large mega IRAs, I think was Professor Gamage's phrase, which is defined as having total retirement assets of $10 million. Not just in IRAs, it's also all kinds of defined contribution plans. And so that's back in, and the idea is that if people are used under President Biden's formulation of high income, namely over $400,000 for singles, $450,000 for marrieds, if they have total retirement assets of over $10 million, number one, they would not be able to add to those accounts. Number two, they would have enhanced, if that's the correct word, required minimum distributions, namely that for accounts that have more than $10 million, people would need to distribute literally half of that excess within the stated period. And if they have more than $20 million, they have to distribute the entire excess over $20 million. Now, one thing that perhaps people should take some comfort from is that this provision as written in the current bill, which to make it easier for people is on page 1896 and page 1906, if people actually access it, would not take effect until 2029. So as written, these provisions would not take effect just yet. And so at that point, not only can people make arrangements, but in addition, there will be several presidential elections before that time, as well as several congressional elections, all of which could easily modify or repeal this provision. Perhaps the one that is the most salient is that it would end the so-called backdoor Roth IRA conversion, and that would apply to everyone regardless of their income. In any case, at this point, I think it's probably a good idea to go to some of the Q&A, and I see at least two questions, probably both of which are directed to Mr. Harder. The first one is about, what about inversions? Can a tax haven still come out ahead with a less than 15% tax rate if it can entice an American company to invert? Chip, you want to take that, please?
Well, there is a feature of the OECD Pillar 2 that's meant to address that, as well as a feature of the proposed legislation. Again, I mentioned earlier the so-called under-tax payment rule, and that basically is meant to apply where a parent jurisdiction has not adopted the minimum tax regime that's like our GILTI regime. And so, you know, let's assume that a U.S. company inverts and becomes headquartered in Barbados, let's say. And what this under-tax payment rule would say is that payments from the U.S. to Barbados don't get any deduction in the United States because they're not taxed at the minimum rate in Barbados. And then with respect to everything that's underneath the United States, well, that's still fully subject to our GILTI regime. And then, you know, in the inversion context, a lot of planning has been to try to get foreign subsidiaries out from under the United States up to the low to be owned directly by the low tax foreign parent. And that's gotten a lot harder given more recent regulations. But even if that were possible, the under-tax payment rule would apply to the payments from a U.S. subsidiary of a Barbados parent to payments of any other subsidiary of the Barbados parent if that related party is not subject to a 15% tax locally. So it's not a complete solution, but it would be a much stiffer gauntlet to run than what we have had historically. Now, again, the United States has not traditionally had an under-tax payment rule like that. The Administration Green Book proposed drafting one, but in the evolution of the bill, it's been the current bidding is that our BEAT, the base erosion anti-avoidant tax regime, would essentially be turned into such an under-tax payment rule, and the BEAT would end up disallowing deductions in the U.S. with respect to payments to foreign-related parties where the payee is not subject to a sufficient level of tax. Basically, more convergence between the U.S. rules and the Pillar 2 rules through this bill, basically repurposing the BEAT to serve as, you know, the equivalent of a Pillar 2 under-tax payment rule. So again, it doesn't completely, you know, eliminate benefits, but it does pretty effectively bring the taxation of almost all income up to a 15% rate, regardless of where you put it. If it's successfully implemented and broadly adopted. So again, two big ifs, but that's the design.
Let me bring in Professor Gamage for the next question, which is, will the millionaire surtax incentivize the wealthy in America to move to other countries?
Okay, I see two questions up there, one about borrowing and one about that. I'll take them both. Since in some ways they're loosely related, or at least I can pretend they're related. So the borrowing question first, because this pops up higher on my screen. The question asks, in talking about buy, borrow, die and related forms of tax planning, especially using corporations, are we talking about borrowing from corporations or lending to corporations? And the answer is borrowing from the corporation, or borrowing using the corporate stock as collateral, or just borrowing because the lender knows you have appreciated corporate stock and thus are worth a very low risk, even if it's not technically or officially collateral. The broader point is, if you can earn your economic income in the form of appreciated assets, including corporate stock, which is quite easy if you're, say, the founder of a startup company, but is also easy if you're a real estate developer or many other ways in which very wealthy economic income is earned. So earning through the form of appreciated assets means no current tax. Then if you want money, it's easy to borrow from banks or other lenders based on the fact that you are known to have this wealth. And so you're very low risk. And so there's all sorts of structured borrowing agreements with very low, trivially low sometimes interest rates. And then the second step of the question asks, what about lending to the corporation? Well, there's actually even a more aggressive version of all of this. So long as you can do business in a way where you can make investments that benefit from expensing rules, or even just accelerated depreciation rules, but it works better. Right now we have full expensing for a wide variety of business assets. If you can fund a business investment with borrowed funds, borrowed at very low interest rates, which if you're ultra wealthy is not that hard, and spend in a way that qualifies for expensing, you've created a nice little tax shelter. And so long as this is a business you are actively engaged in, you can potentially generate deductions that can even offset salary income or income that otherwise would be fully taxed. So there's a wide world out there of variations on what we call buy, borrow, die. But a key step in all of these transactions is, to the extent you need money, you don't sell or otherwise trigger realization of appreciated assets. You borrow or do an economic transaction that is economically similar to borrowing. There's alternatives to borrowing that also similarly allow you to get cash effectively from the fact that you are borrowing worthy, meaning you have appreciated assets or other wealth, without triggering any current tax. Does the millionaire surtax incentivize the wealthy in America to move to other countries? So it's interesting. Often when we talk about mobility of the wealthy, we're talking about those with great financial wealth. The Larry Ellisons, the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world. And for them, for sure not. Because we have a citizenship-based tax system, which means that tax is going to be owed wherever you live in the world. And if you renounce your citizenship, which is the only way to get out of that citizenship-based tax system, you have triggering of all of your unrealized gains. So a massive tax bill. Some people occasionally do this, but they're almost always people like the lesser known founder of Facebook, Eduardo Severin, I'm probably pronouncing his name wrong, who lived, I believe, in Singapore for a long time before renouncing citizenship and effectively wasn't doing this for tax reasons. In fact, it was a negative tax move, as I understand it. He was doing it because he wanted to live in Singapore. People do migrate for a wide variety of reasons, but our tax system for those who have large amounts of built-in gains, large financial wealth, makes it so that it's almost never a tax avoidance move to migrate and renounce citizenship. On the other hand, there's a different literature on mobility for superstar sports athletes and superstar scientists, and those who the smaller number of the what we might call working rich, you know, multimillionaires, but not billionaires who have largely salary income. Most of that research is either at the US state level or at the European level, but it does find effects of taxes on salary income. So at least among the European context or the US state level context, higher taxes on salary wage income as the millionaire surtax is, can have a measurable, or not huge, effect on which country people choose to locate in. But I don't know that we have much of a literature on this moving from the US to other nations. Chip, David, wants to jump in on this, I think.
Would the Biden or the Wyden proposal to mark to market, unrealized gains of billionaires, change this dynamic? Again, I'm not a student of the Wyden proposal, but once we've gone through the first mark and the billionaire has a full fair market value basis in all of his assets, I would think there would be a powerful incentive for him to immediately expatriate at no additional marginal cost, unless the proposals change the expatriation rules. So that this has always been a puzzle to me with respect to the Wyden mark proposal.
So you have to remember that the Wyden proposal, at least the version of it proposed last week, right? These are all subject to revisions, partly for a political compromise, only did a full mark to market for publicly traded assets, stocks, bonds, and the like, which is about a third of the total wealth of billionaires. Much larger portions of billionaire wealth are kept in privately held businesses, but very few billionaires have all of their wealth in publicly traded assets. Some have a large portion. So for non-publicly traded assets, there is still a deferral regime with an interest charge and shutting down of loopholes. If the hypothetical billionaire who only had publicly traded assets, it is true that the current tax disincentive from moving abroad and then renouncing US citizenship would be gone. That doesn't mean there would be a strong tax incentive to do so. Potentially, you would only get there by paying tax on all your prior built-in gains, and it would only be for future gains that you would potentially have a benefit. And you can already get that by moving to Puerto Rico under current law and staying there and really living there long enough in a much easier way, actually. But for the majority of billionaires who have significant, often the majority of their wealth in privately held forms, there would still be quite a substantial tax disadvantage from renouncing US citizenship. Although less of a disadvantage than under current law, for sure.
Thank you, David. I think that's really all the time we have. I do want to close by thanking my incredibly impressive panelists, Mr. Chip Harder and my academic colleague, Professor David Gamage. And I also want to thank the Federalist Society for organizing this and sponsoring it again. This is our second time as a group, and I think we're beginning to gel and look forward to the next episode. I'll leave it to Mr. Benson to take it from here. Thank you, Richard.
Indeed. Thank you, panelists, for being able to come and share your wisdom tonight with everyone. Just to remind anyone listening who's curious about what the Chicago chapter is doing next, we're going to have a break for in-person events for the winter. But if you're interested in a Midwest conference in Springfield, a lot of CLE available will be on April 23rd. And we'll have an in-house council symposium for anyone who happens to be in-house at all at May 14th at the Union League Club in Chicago. So please feel free to mark your calendars and register when those links come out. Thank you so much to everyone, our panelists, and for those of you attending, and I hope you have a wonderful evening.